question about like your background and getting to experimental music, the route that you took. Where did it come from? Where was your initial music interest?
The experimental part was I got this job at, a couple years out of college at a film editing company, and the guy who ran the place, it was a real small kind of boutique film editing company that did huge like American Express and like all these people, and I started working at this film editing company, and it was great. It was like I'd walk into a session where Buster Poindexter is doing the voiceover for an American Express commercial and like all this stuff, and it was like, but the guy who ran the place was, you know, you look on his CD chart and it's like Hafler Trio and like all this sort of like 80s like industrial stuff, but then he'll have Carla Bley's Escalator Over the Hill and other stuff, and all I had access to it. And
were you doing earlier though? Like, where's you, before getting this kind of stuff? You're playing a rock band?
It was indie rock, you know, stuff.
What kind of groups?
And I played in a band called Ditch Croker for a while, which was.
And this is New York based stuff?
This is New York based, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we sort of took the whole DIY thing on and put out a bunch of 7-inches and a couple of CDs. And then even though we were like this holding this sort of like DIY thing, as soon as Reprise Records called us up one day and we were like, yes, we'll absolutely, we'll be there tomorrow.
You had the red phone ringing.
Yeah. Okay. And then it was funny, it was that as soon as we got into that kind of situation, we knew we were fucked. It was just like, it didn't take long. We were just like, we signed these contracts and everything while we were recording the record for them. And we went out for a visit and all the people we met and everything, it was just, we knew that it was just like, you know what? They are not going to hold that. We had like a 3-record deal on the table, and that's what, and for this like dudes from who were living in Hoboken, New Jersey at the time, you know, and it was like,
and what year was this?
The hell happened like 94, 95.
Okay.
So it was like a 3-record deal. We had a really great, you know, they were going to get us a van, they had all this kind of stuff in our contract, you know, this classic sort of stuff. And yeah, and it lasted like a year, maybe, you know, maybe a little bit more.
Did you end up owing the money?
No. The great part was that our lawyer got into the contract that if we were dropped before the 3 records were done, we would get half of the recording budgets for the remaining 2 records that were done.
Okay, so you had some intelligence behind what you were doing.
We our bass player went to UPenn, so that helped out.
That helped.
Just sort of like just the kind of like being in the moment. And again, we had a great lawyer, so it was really we walked away with it out actually on top. There was like some change at Reprise, and you know, we weren't part of the change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were coming out of that kind of a scene.
Yeah,
sort of
yeah,
at
that
this
was
place,
it, yeah.
Introduced to a bunch of music you'd never heard before.
Yeah, I had been working at this place for a while, so I guess, you know, slowly it was like seeping in, but it was definitely a songs based, you know, thing that we were doing. But then that ended and I started I got asked to play on a Silver Jews record and American Water, and that was kind of like the first thing that sent me to this other place where I wasn't just playing with some dudes that were in a band that got dropped by a record label. It was like David Berman, and it was like, oh my god, this is pretty amazing. And you know, I worked my ass off like to make sure I came up with some really great parts for that record, you know. And that was like the next that was sort of like the next sort of step, and then it just sort of went from there. And then shortly after that I met Jim O'Rourke, and actually through my work at the film editing company, there was this PSA for like an anti-heroin kind of thing that was going on, and And they said, can we do the sound design for it? And so I'm doing the sound design, and I was just like, man, you know, it was a great opportunity to get some of like Jim's like early solo stuff like in there. And so I called him up, and he's like, yeah, here, I'll send you some stuff. And he sent some stuff over, and we put it into the TV commercial, and next thing it was like CMJ or something like that. And we hung out, and we kind of hit it off mm-hmm. as friends. And then, you know, a couple months later, I was in Chicago playing Shaker on his Eureka record. Oh, okay, so it was like, I think it might have been, I don't know, the same time you were doing
the saxophone.
The saxophone. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was kind of the sort of like the, the people that saw, you know, I don't know, something in what I was doing and whatever.
And today you were talking about how the sound design work impacted the way you thought about music, and how did that impact it? I mean,
it just totally informed it in a way that, like, I was sitting there learning how, it was like the early days of like a digital editing systems, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and this was before Pro Tools came out and stuff, and it really, it still looked kind of like an Atari, you know, kind of like game, you know, this like these first, some of these first tools. And I was, because I was Hank, the guy who owned the company, and I was his assistant, he would always just, he was the kind of guy who can't cut a frame of film without sound effects or music or anything. He needed those things to kind of help push along his process. And so I would go in there, and I would take, you know, a door slam or whatever, and I'd crank up the reverb all the way as far it could go, as far as it could go, and I'd take it to him, and he'd be like, "This is amazing! You know, how'd you do that?" You know, and it was kind of like, you know, I was there, I couldn't do no wrong in terms of like going into this like nice little sound room and making stuff for him, mm-hmm. and then I would also start. It then turned into like bringing in music tracks and stuff too, and then that also, that going back and forth with him, mm-hmm. And the fact that some of the stuff that he had turned me on to was, and being in New York and everything, was all these things together that just kind of collided at the same time and mm-hmm. in a way, and were feeding me to push off in this other direction. Then, maybe, do you know Steve Dolachinsky?
Sure.
Yeah, so Steve Dolachinsky is this guy who's, he's a poet, and he makes, you know, collages and stuff like that now. And he used to sell records on Spring Street, where Lost Planet, the company that I worked for, was. And he started kind of like, oh, Tim, you should check this out. You know, and it was his way of getting me to buy a lot of his records that he didn't want anymore, of course. But I learned this later. That was also the other thing. And then he said, you know, you should go to this thing called the Vision Festival and check this out. And it was year number two. Of the Vision Fest, and I went down there, and I walked in, and William Parker was serving, you know, chicken legs and black eyed peas and greens and stuff like that, and I just experienced this whole scene of people that just totally cracked open my skull. That was just, it was so inviting and so like open in a way.
Do you remember from, who played at that one?
I got to see like Lawrence Cook on drum, wow. You know, big chains over the drum kit, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then seeing Susie Ibarra for the first time and just being like, totally blown away by what she was doing. And I have very fond memories of that experience. Yeah. And that also just kind of informed how I then started putting on shows and stuff, and how I would, you know, treat people and have food there or have like something mm-hmm. that just made it special. So it wasn't just like people going out to a bar and like having to experience, mm-hmm. you know, something.
Yeah, helping to create an
environment. Create something. Yeah, exactly. I mean, Issue Project Room. We all know Issue Project Room, you know. So Issue Project Room was the very first concert that was at Issue, what was called Issue at the time. It was just it was a art magazine that was trying to be this art magazine. And they put out their first magazine, and they invited Kim Gordon and myself and O'Rourke and Alan Licht and maybe a couple other folks to play mm-hmm. at it. And I I told Suzanne, I was just like, you have a great space here for shows. You should really think about doing shows. And that's where like Nate Woolley and I played and did some stuff together and it was just kind of a really great time.
And you left New York how many years ago now?
I moved to Louisville in 2007.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're doing a bunch of stuff there. I mean, you're continuing not just the playing part, but also the presentation part. I mean, that's how we met.
Yeah. Dreamland is a venue that I run and down there. And I've gone through all these like just bad retail jobs. When I left New York, I was kind of done with like advertising and sort of done even with music to a certain extent. I had done all this work and I was sitting there doing the dumbest thing ever, like asking like why and what, you know, about it. And it really was so, in retrospect, like it was just such a bad, you know, I was just in this bad place in terms of thinking about what I was trying to do. But going through these retail jobs, it was all like outdoor industry kind of stuff, and I really got into running and everything, and which was, again, sort of short-lived. But what happened is that I got into it, and when someone kind of obsessive like myself does something, it's like I don't just do it. That's like it goes so stupidly beyond like what someone should try to do. And I was running the 100-mile races and stuff like that.
We're talking a little bit about ideas, and last night we played in Milwaukee a couple sets of improvised music as a duo, and the material is quite different in general from the material you work with tonight.
Yeah.
And when we were taking the train back, you talked about trying to work off of, let's say, simple ideas and pushing them to see if they could succeed or not. And it brought to me my own personal fascination with how people discover material. And we talked a little bit about John Butcher versus Evan Parker to super simplify, like Evan Parker looked at some details and to use a couple examples, Pharoah Sanders' work and John Coltrane's work, the harmonics and attacks and tonguing attacks, and made a universe out of that. And John Butcher, for a long time, because he's also English, I assumed, and he's younger than Evan, I assumed he was influenced by Evan Parker's work, which is actually not the case when I heard him talk. And his approach, like in a sense, Evan Parker took the most saxophone-istic elements of the saxophone that had nothing to do with conventional music and like blew them up into another world.
Yeah.
And John Butcher said, everything that's related to the saxophone I want to eradicate. And it kind of like put his playing into a very awkward position for a number of years. And I just think in terms of how do you, when you take, you say simple ideas that you kind of explore to see if they push and fall over and if they're sustainable, how do you come up with that? Like in the case of Evan, he's like, he looked at a set of specifics and explored those. John tried to wipe the slate clean. I mean, when you talk about working with ideas that lead to this kind of work, is it highly conceptual or is it just intuitive, or do you reduce the means
they become conceptual? I think that when you just like this whole thing, it's like, you know, I found this coil in my house one day. It was like sitting on my dresser, and I didn't know where it came from. It looks like it belongs like to an IKEA piece of furniture or something, and I picked it up and just, you know, like any percussionist knows what to do. When you find something, you kind of like, does it do something, you know, that I can use, you know? and that's what happened. And then why I jammed a coin in it, like, I don't know where that came from. I just sort of did, because I thought that it was going to, and it did do what I thought it was going to do, which was just change the tension on one end rather than, mm-hmm. So you have two things, and then you also have the coin to actually then make a sound too, as that becomes part of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. At first I kind of stumble across these things. Some of them are the things I have to steal from my kids that are like their little art project or whatever, and I, you know, that looks good for daddy, you know. I put myself in a situation where I'm going to go down and record underneath this bridge and blah, blah, blah. And so then, like, what else can I do? Oh, yeah, let's grab that styrofoam balls and just, like, and then, you know, becomes this thing. Okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to, like, throw these things around, make sure I don't move while they're moving. And then once those balls settle, then I can move to the next thing and then put them in motion again. And so mm-hmm. it's on the spot kind of coming up with, but then you kind of start trying to refine it to the, you know, not to the point where you ruin it, but you kind of are still, there's a lot of opportunity for it to
and
kick around.
What's the motivation to work that way? Like, let's say you're coming out of a rock background, you encounter all this other work, improvisers, you know, turns your head around, and now, like, okay, is it that you want to push further into something you don't know, or...
Yeah, I think it's pushing past what I do know, and I think that's the biggest thing for me. I think that, you know, I retired my cymbal bow, you know, for and that's, you know, for a reason. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's we all, you know, free improvised music is a genre, but it's also it's nice when it can be truly what it says it is, and that's free, you know, mm-hmm. and that it's not carrying on a traditionalism mm-hmm. aspect of it. There's, you know, it's, I think the best aspect of it is to keep it free and to keep on pushing it into free. Mm-hmm. And what does that even mean for someone? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could be someone who's got into it, you know, later, they still maybe work through that process, but then people that have been doing it for a long time, you know, it's time to, you know, put some of those, you know, some of those tools away, I think, mm-hmm. and give them a rest and, you know, mm-hmm. and invest, so you can investigate certain things. They don't need to be always sort of simple ideas, but it's, for me right now, I think it's, that's the best thing for me.
It leads, you know, to a way to push this.
Yeah.
That's fruitful.
Yeah. And, you know, I always have this sort of self-deprecating drummer thing too, that, you know, I grew up, you know, teaching myself how to play drums. I didn't really get into playing jazz. I played jazz band like ninth grade or something like that. And I was like the loudest and the worst drummer in the group, you know, and I just didn't have that feel, mm-hmm. you know? And so when I play free improvised music, it's, you know, it's definitely informed by, you know, you can hear it for sure in, you know, Lovins, Litton, mm-hmm. Bennett, you know, like all those people, especially European stuff, like, you know, hearing Tony Oxley, just that was a huge moment for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was going through some of the records you gave me, and two more or less randomly, I listened to this one with Jeff German.
Oh, yeah.
The Matterings record, because that was more recent, and you were going to do a tour with him. And then this record, A Water's Wake, with Marina Rosenfeld and Toshio Kajiwara.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was asking you about them because they both deal with, let's say, experimental music in different ways.
Yeah.
And I asked about the Waters Wake record, like, was that a strict performance that was documented and recorded?
Yeah.
The Matterings record was that, so, and they were like almost made opposite.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, the Matterings record was built and assembled and,
yeah,
and you know, worked very hard in the studio process, let's say.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other was a document of a performance. Do you think, I mean, clearly the organization of the materials is quite different. And the process is quite different because you have a lot of time to work in the studio and you're doing a concert and it's immediate.
Yeah.
How do you think about that work differential? Like, do you think, oh, I'm doing something totally different here, I have to think about it totally differently in terms of what am I making? Or is it just natural to have this spectrum that's split pretty wide? For some people, it'd be too wide.
It wouldn't work. You know, way. I mean, I think when the source, it kind of depends on the source, I think, too. Like, if when we played together in Louisville, all right, we had Dave came down and we recorded like our stuff and everything, and like that's you accept that as this like live performance, and we know someone has captured it in a really fantastic way, and maybe there is a little wiggle room to kind of, you know, edit a moment here or there or whatever. I love sitting in front of a computer screen and like making something really sharp and, and to the what I want it to be. And I really love that aspect of it. And again, that's the whole sound designer thing of me, of this like needing the control of placing something and making it happen where I think it should happen. But the live thing though, I think that, you know, I accept that as that, and I thought
you let go of the total control.
Yeah, I let go of the control. I mean, there may be one thing where I'm just like, you know, and you just, you know, just the, you know, cut that little sliver out or whatever if it's really something. But I mean, I think maybe over the years I got maybe a little bit relaxed about that, but maybe not. I'm not sure. Yeah. It's.
Well, I find it interesting because you talked about the Matterings record and then doing the tour with Jeff.
Yeah.
And I asked how you worked on that. I feel like everything in the recording process, the making of the album was so controlled. And what do you do live?
Yeah.
And the way you explained it to me, if I understood correctly, was you took the recorded elements and distributed them into a way to use those elements in performance.
Yeah.
So people who are interested in that particular approach to playing or whatever would have a connection to the actual album, but you weren't just playing the files back.
Yeah, right. It was like,
so what do you think about that? Like, that's like I find that quite fascinating, actually.
You know, I think what's nice about it is that you're taking, because a lot of the elements that we made, they're recordings, they're like field recordings, and they're, you know, elements from, you know, things that we wouldn't really be able to recreate live. Jeff and I really wanted to present, like when people got to hear us live, I wanted to present the work that we made on the record and not just show up two dudes and with drum kits being like, well, we're really drummers and we're going to sit here and drum, you know, for the night. And we really wanted to show people what, you know, have them experience this record. But what we did was we kind of split it and we took the main elements, the things that people would, anyone who had listened to the record before we went and toured, they would recognize this sound or that sound from the record. And so we omitted certain parts of other tracks on the record. So there was space for us to insert what we wanted to do. Does anyone know that band Mirror? These guys that were like kind of like an ambient group that, you know, and the first time I saw them play at a festival in Scotland, I think they just had like a bunch of CD players and they were just like mixing this thing. And that's where like I think I got the idea of you could do that, you know, that mm-hmm. that was allowed, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you have all these components that you've redistributed.
Yeah.
You're playing them back, mixing them. Were you also doing, say, spontaneous or real-time things at the time, interacting with the recorders?
Totally. And that was also an evolution over the tour. You know, I think people appreciated it too, mm-hmm. the way we did it. You know, no one came to me and said, "Man, you're just playing that stuff off of this machine." But I think it went really well. I mean, I always find that
maybe it's because I'm a horn player and I come out of like a jazz background, seeing musicians play and performance, that the performance aspect of, like, let's say laptop work or mm-hmm. like live mixing work or mm-hmm. whatever, the material may be extraordinary, but the watching of the performance can often be hyper problematic, because it's mm-hmm. like, well, I won't mention the names, but there's people who have told me that they were doing their email at the gig.
Oh, right. You
know?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
like they can send the files to the speakers and like,
yeah, right.
Which seems a little bit multitasking, not in the most genuine way from a music standpoint.
Sure.
But I just wonder, like, in
some
terms
people
of,
make bad choices. That's for
this
sure.
is true.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, like, in terms of, like, when you think about working in that way, like with Jeff or whatever, is the performance aspect, like, do you feel a lack in performance if you see a show, like you say the Mirror show, where like, okay, they're playing a bunch of CDs and mixing them live, and okay, maybe it's extraordinary music, but do you feel a disconnect from the physical presence of performance,
you know,
there,
I wasn't,
or does not matter?
I wasn't sure, like, when we went into, that was the one component mm-hmm. that I wasn't sure about, like, how I would personally feel, like, after performing this stuff mm-hmm. but when you're in it, you're like hyper focused, and you're like
right.
I was drained after every concert that we did mm-hmm. you know, it was just because it was like, all right, coming up next and da 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 da, and this mm-hmm. is gonna do this, and I gotta flip to this tape, and then I gotta like get the bell and ding 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 ding, do that part, and you know, mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff that I had been working out throughout the tour mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. So there was this.
So for you, it's the context is performance. Like, you're focused in a way, like, let's
say. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So from that standpoint, it's equal territory.
So yeah, I thought so. I mean, it's definitely not, you know, that intense mm-hmm. free improvisation energy, you know, mm-hmm. where it's just, you know, mm-hmm. that. But it's a whole, totally other, mm-hmm. you know, other mm-hmm. thing.
Just playing with you last night and working, let's say, with history, various histories connected to like improvised music and mm-hmm. even some jazz elements or whatever, and finding other things that we did that were, I would say, discovered at the
mm-hmm.
time.
Sure.
And then what you were working with tonight, mm-hmm. very, very different ways of doing things, and then the work with Jeff German.
Yeah.
Clearly you're like working in a very broad way.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and it's, I'm a huge music fan. You know, I love music, you know, mm-hmm. and I love creating. I mean, I think that's the other part. It's like, I love sitting down with people and creating music, you know, mm-hmm. and creating a situation to make music, or creating, you know, an opportunity for someone else to make music. You know, I love that mm-hmm. part. And that's just like, I need it, you mm-hmm. know, in so many ways. And so that's what still keeps me interested in, like, it'd be disingenuous for me to be like, oh, I don't play rock music anymore. I'm, you know, mm-hmm. I do this other thing, and it's not true. You know, it's like mm-hmm. if the right, you know, sort of project or whatever, or an opportunity comes up, you know, that's, try to go for it. Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah. And I think, like, Keith Rowe, for some reason, had issues with me because of that. You know, mm-hmm. like, he just was never...
I don't think it's just you.
Well, yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, well, I can miss it. But I think that again, that's that part of that whole idea that, you know, again, it's... We're talking about freedom, you know, mm-hmm. and freeness of doing what you want to do and to express something, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in a, you know, a tradition, you mm-hmm. know. But, you know, outside of that, I think I played with Neil Haggerty, like, for the first time, it was Royal Trucks had just ended and he was doing his solo stuff. And man, talk about being free. I mean, that was the probably the freest, one of the freest, like, bands I've ever played in was with him, because it was like, he was just like, do your thing. You know, it would kind of bum me out a little bit, because he would like be like, man, I want it to be just like harmonic. And, you know, he would drop these, you know, these ornette phrases and stuff like that, which were cool. I know he was genuine for wanting to do that, or at least in his mind wanting to do that, have that kind of vibe, but it was, I didn't necessarily need to have all that information. I just, when he said, like, it's going to be open, like, I knew what that was, because I had been, you know, I'd been playing in that world, and so being in his, playing with him for, I think it was like 2 years we played together, and maybe three, and where it's first started out as this, like, really big band of, like, two bass players and two drummers, and then him, and then it over the year, like, as the years passed and the different tours, like, one person got dropped, like, every time, because he couldn't as much as he wanted to, he couldn't sustain the, hey, we're going to stay in a hotel room every night, and blah 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 blah. He had really sort of like some strict rules about, like, what he wanted, you know, to do. And and yeah, in the end, it was me and Dan, this guy Dan Brown, and Neil, as it was just like this power trio, and that was dynamite, man. I loved that. We played at out at UCLA when the All Tomorrow's Parties was out there. At Sonic Youth, I think, was the curator that year, and it was awesome. I remember O'Rourke coming up to me after the show and be like, man, you never play like that on my records. It's like, man, you never give me a space to, you never give me the space to do that kind of thing. Everything's like, you know, like, locked in. And
great. No. Cool. Well, any questions for Mr. Barnes while he's in Chicago?
Living in New York, moving to Louisville, how has it changed your approach to your work, if it has?
I think it... Living in Louisville has allowed me to not play as much, and to think about what I'm doing more. And I think that's also, I think, a big part of what this is. And I'm away from everyone else. I don't need to, you know, John Abbey to, like, comment on, like, what I'm doing, or someone else that's in some other scene to comment on what I'm doing or whatever. It's like, it's just coming from this one place. And I think I let that, you know, early in my time there, I would, especially when, like, you know, that whole reduction thing was like, had this, like, super heavy fever going on. There was a lot of that kind of, you know, mouthing off, you know, sort of stuff behind closed doors. But so I think just being, you know, not having that in my backyard and being able to just kind of think more about my ideas and also have the time to. I mean, the other part about being in Louisville is that, you know, you got nothing but time. You know? I mean, there's a lot
space.
Yeah, and you can think about stuff, and it's a small city, so you're not on the blocks to be playing all the time and whatnot. Right. And if you are, you're probably not doing yourself a good service. But the you know, I can say that because I run a venue, and, you know. But yeah, I think that's it, Tim. I think that's being able just to think about it more.